Irregular migration is often cited as one of the driving factors for public sentiments in Europe. Such narratives have driven election campaigns, caused changes of government, and even in some countries, including media outlets, it's seen as a threat to the economic and social fabric of receiving countries. In this episode of the Migration Podcast by ICMPD, we unpack how people lose or gain status, the circumstances people can be caught in, and the role that state policies play in migrants' access to status or irregularity. Joining me today are two of ICMPD's experts. Megan Hendo is one of our senior researchers and has expertise in irregular migration policies, border management, and migrant smuggling, among others. Also with us is Veronica Bilger, the head of the research unit at ICMPD. Veronica also has worked in research projects on migration governance, migrant smuggling, and human trafficking and irregular migration. Veronica, Megan, thank you for joining us. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Hello, thank you for inviting us.
Could we please start with a brief introduction of the MIREM project and the ICMPD research under this wider research program?
The MIREM project stands for Measuring Irregular Migration and Related Policies. In our study, we looked at irregular migration policies. Within the larger research project, we of course look at data and a number of different research strands, but there's one research strand that we have led on policies and how policies impact on migrants' access to status or the ways that they might lose status. And we looked at 20 countries, the majority of which are EU countries, and six non-EU countries at the EU's borders, but also the US and Canada. And we looked at, for example, how policies have shifted over time. So what kind of events or actors have shifted policy development on this topic over time, and what have been some main policy priorities in the field of irregular migration across the 20 countries under study. So the major bulk of the study looks at how policies provide irregular migrants with access to status, but also may impact on how migrants may lose status or may define their irregularity themselves. So, for example, somebody crossing a border becomes irregular only once they cross that border. Another research strand in the project is also looking at innovative methodological approaches for estimating irregular migration, and also it will have a specific research strand on regularization policies as well. And then the last section of the report looks at what kind of challenges have emerged in terms of how states have implemented policies related to irregular migration.
Why did we do the study?
It's part of the Horizon Research Program of the European Commission. We responded together as a partner with a huge consortium involving many partners. It builds on an earlier project, and that was the reference project for understanding the size of the so-called irregular population. That was the Clandestino project, which was also a European project. A large consortium estimated for the first time comparatively and looked into what can we say about irregular migration in terms of numbers and what can we not say. So that was the first project to come out also with methodologies for estimating. And this is what MIREM now builds on and, of course, goes beyond.
Thank you. The study also looks into the different angles in which several of the recent events, especially in the last decade, could have triggered and rather shifted these triggering events. To name a few, we have the financial crisis of 2008 and 2010, migration crisis of 2015, the terror attacks in Paris, in Brussels, in Germany, COVID, of course, Ukraine. How do all these events tie together in the whole narrative of irregular migration? And how have these shifted the policies?
Yeah. After the invasion of Ukraine, also since 2022, you also see a shift in how irregular migration is being discussed at the EU's external borders, at the eastern borders. So, for example, you see discussions at the EU level and in Poland on the instrumentalization of migration at the Poland-Belarus border, and also in Finland. One of the shifts identified was that border security and security as an element has become really important in discussing irregular migration, where it was not as much in the forefront before 2022, given Finland's border with Russia. But I think something important also when we look at the different types of events is also that it's not always leading to more restrictive policies or negative sentiments that towards irregular migrants or migrants in general. You see, for example, the large-scale arrivals of Ukrainians in 2022 was more positively received, although that arrival was not an irregular one, because Ukrainians, of course, had visa-free status in the EU. You mentioned also the Eurozone crisis in 2010-2011 that meant to implement or maintain more liberal measures towards irregular migrants. So for Greece, for example, since the crisis led to high rates of unemployment of migrants and also then led to precarity of migration status and difficulties that migrants faced in renewing their status, there were policy adjustments to reduce the number of days required of social security contributions to renew their residence permits for migrants to prevent people from falling into irregularity. In Italy, in 2012, the Monti government also implemented a regularization program, for example, that regularized a number of irregular migrants. And in Portugal, although it was under a right-wing government, it still also maintained its 2007 regularization mechanism legislation. Another example would be the policy responses to the COVID-19 pandemic. So, of course, we're all aware of the mobility restrictions that I think also all of us faced. But we also see a number of policies that widened migrants' access, irregular or not, but their access to healthcare in terms of access to vaccines. And in Ireland, also in 2022, they implemented two regularization programs. So one was to regularize long-term undocumented migrants, and the other also regularized those who were waiting still for a decision on their asylum claim. And this was also, the idea was to clear the backlog in the asylum process that was accrued during the pandemic. So overall, when we look at the role of different events, I think it's a mixed bag in terms of also how it shifts policies and approaches and also sentiment.
How do people lose their status? How do they become irregular?
So people can become irregular in a number of different ways. So in some cases, for example, if you're born as a child, if you're born to parents that have irregular status in the host country, you might not have access to status yourself. Some countries have responded to this issue. So for example, Portugal allows children of irregular migrants who are resident in the country to have access to residency. But also, for example, I think what is in everybody's mind when we talk about irregular migration is the irregular crossing of borders. Of course, that is one way as well. But another major way that people lose status is either by overstaying their visa or working in contravention of their visa. Sometimes this can be because they lose employment or even also because of policy changes from the state's side. So, for example, in Finland, they removed the access to protection for humanitarian grounds. And so all those who had previously had access to status under that provision no longer had that status. You also have examples of befallen irregularity. So that would be cases where, for example, the process itself is so long and or difficult that people can lose status during the process. Also, you have the similar situation in terms of where there's a large backlog. So we saw that, for example, in the case of the US, where you have years-long backlog of visa renewals or new visas, where people may no longer be eligible for their for the visa that they've applied for because the process itself has taken too long.
One of the results of the study shows that even EU nationals within the European Union could also fall into irregularity. Could we briefly discuss this?
Well, yeah, I don't think it's any different than any other migrant. So it would be the same sense of if you have a visa-free national who overstays 90 days, that's the same situation, for example, for EU nationals. If they stay in a country for more than 90 days, then they are in violation of the terms of their presence. And if they stay any longer, then they would be considered irregular. A straightforward way in policy to address that is that all that EU nationals would have to do would be to register their stay. So even if they stay for longer than 90 days, maybe they have to pay also a fine, but they must only register with the authorities, and that's a way that they regularize their status in the country.
We have heard, and I know we have already discussed how established the term is, or rather the guidance on not using the word illegal on people. Why shouldn't we call them illegal? And even the word irregular addressed to people, why should we avoid this terminology?
Because there is nothing illegal about human being. That's the first answer. But then, of course, also from a research and analytical perspective, if we talk about irregular migration and less about irregular migrants, we call it irregular migration also because it reflects the way of how this migration, this particular movements are organized. So if you look at the journeys, many individuals actually might slide in and out of regularity. And from my point of view, where you could use the term is in a border crossing, but that doesn't refer to the person. So that refers to how a person crosses the border. So the individual persons, they might cross a border with proper documents. They might cross another border without the documents. All this together, if you had a huge file of a person irregularly on the move, you could see all types of status there. You could find a visa, you could find an illegal border crossing, you could find a protection status if persons applied for asylum. So that's why it's not so easy. So on irregular stay, Megan gave examples already on how to get into irregularity in the country. So losing status, this is what it is about, when already present on the territory. So what is important is irregular migration is a certain way of moving. What we see increasingly is there is a tension between the concepts of irregularity and flight. So it's less about the terminology we use, but it's more about the concepts in particularly public discourse. So irregular migration is a way of moving. Individual persons might do parts of their journey regularly or irregularly with proper documents or without proper documents. So what we can see is regular migration and irregularity increasingly as is used as a proxy for talking about asylum. So this is problematic. So there might be irregular migration, yes, but it is describing a way of moving and not describing why people move, and fleeing and seeking protection is about the reason why people leave a country. If I can give you an historic example, in the 1990s, when we started discussing irregular migration in like the broader context, the large numbers of irregular arrivals concerned labor migrants from the countries neighboring the EU at that time. So as Megan already explained, this is all about, it's more about status than about people. And the examples from the 1990s, at the example we see that with the accession of the then EU neighboring countries to the EU, so for example, Romania, Bulgaria, and the introduction of temporary labor migration schemes for nationals of these countries and others, the numbers of irregular arrivals dramatically reduced. So with accession to the EU, certain nationals from one day to the other were not considered irregular migrants. And nothing had changed in these persons. And nothing had changed in the way they themselves decided to move. And conversely, as another example, from 2008 and 2010, in France, for example, during the global financial crisis, permits for temporary workers were significantly reduced for nationals from North African countries. And 1 year later, the number of irregular arrivals from North African countries had increased by almost the same number that were roughly 40,000. So you see, there is the connection to how we regulate flows and less on the people and their moving. Another example could be the Ukrainians displaced. They, similar to other nationals fleeing war, with the activation of the Temporary Protection Directive in 2022, the EU member states decided to allow Ukrainian mobility and to allow Ukrainians to access their territories freely for a certain period of time. They leave for the same reason like other nationalities leave, but we don't see any irregular migration among the Ukrainians. There is a mix-up in the rhetoric, and there is a mix-up in the data. These are two categories that should be considered separately much more than is currently the case, and we are trying hard to do this also with the Mirren project. There is colleagues working on understanding apprehension numbers at the border of irregular migrants for residence or stay, and refugee flows and how they go together or how they do not go together.
To be clear, it's not about the people, it's about the process in which they fall into. Can we just clarify who are not irregular migrants?
People who have a right to protection. It can be victims of crime, it can be victims of trafficking, it can be children, it can be asylum seekers, and so on. And
when they're given a permit to stay, that's the point.
To be more on the positive side of things, at least, what are the ways in which people can gain status? What are the channels, the policies, and even the countries' differing approaches to this?
For the study, basically what we found were there's a number of ways that people gain status. Again, also, as we said before, provisional statuses such as asylum, when you're given a status based on, for example, waiting on a decision on the asylum case, or, for example, for permits provided to victims of crime, such as victims of trafficking, usually it's conditional on the participation in a criminal trial. Another example of a provisional status would be the Duldung in Germany, where, for example, people that cannot return are provided a specific provisional status. So in a number of countries, in Italy, for example, you can have, and also in Germany, you can have access to a temporary status during pregnancy and after the child is born. In the Portuguese case, if the child can be regularized, and through that also the parents might also have access to regular status. In terms of the regularization programs and mechanisms, so there's the usual ones that I think are often discussed are regularization programs. For a specific time, people that meet a certain criteria can request for a permit. There's also, they're usually called amnesties in the Italian case, but you also have examples of mechanisms where there's something encoded in the law by which somebody can request a regular status. Or you have individual actors who are mandated to provide status, such as in the Netherlands. One interesting finding that we had was that across all the countries under study, so there's not a single country that doesn't have a mechanism by which somebody can regularize their status. You have the regularization mechanisms, like in Portugal and Spain, that are often discussed, but you don't often discuss these smaller scale mechanisms that exist in all countries. So those that offer, for example, people who are victims of crime to regularize, that would be a regularization mechanism encoded in law. But it's discussed always very differently. Those are the examples within the country where somebody can gain status in the country. But you also, of course, can gain a status upon return. So when you return a citizen to their country of origin, you, of course, they are no longer irregular. However, what we found was that there's other issues that can emerge. For example, in some cases, you have the criminalization of irregular exit. So in our study, that was the case in Morocco and Tunisia. So in case you have someone who returned, who has irregularly exited the country, they might face prosecution or certain issues upon return. You also have issues where people are not returned to their country of origin, but rather to a third country. And in that case, they do not necessarily have access to status unless they are able to lodge an asylum claim. You also have cases where you might be irregular in one country, and then you migrate onwards to another country. So, for example, in France, France no longer counts you as part of their irregular population, but, for example, maybe the UK does, unless you are claiming asylum, and then you would have access to status.
The study also shows that some people choose to be irregular. Why is that?
I understand the question is that people would remain with irregular status, even though they might be eligible for status. And the reasons for that are manifold. Across the countries under study, you have practical reasons, so cost or burden of proof. For example, if there's a regularization program, but there's a high burden of proof, such as, for example, hardship, or the resources also needed to access the pathway. For example, the amount of the cost of accessing that status or that process. Another issue that came up was also the fear that accessing this pathway or making yourself known to the authorities will have negative consequences. This was in a lot of the countries under study. And especially in the case where legal advice and counseling requires contacting a state authority, this can be an even higher barrier. One expert said many people are not willing to explore this pathway to regularization, given it entails running the risk of deportation, so they stay undocumented. Another reason could be that they don't know about it. So there could be either that they're uncertain that they would be eligible, or it could be high legal complexity or a lack of multilingual information. And some people may also just not trust that it'll actually offer them a tangible path out of irregularity or to regular status. Because, for example, they have known experiences of friends or family who didn't have a positive outcome. Yeah, so it's also about the trust that that migrants might have in the state institutions and their worry that interacting with state institution might mean that they would be deported or have negative consequences for themselves or their families. So I mentioned how people can lose their status is also due to changes in policies or state bureaucracy, such as befallen irregularity and backlogs. But on the way here today, we were also talking about that I mean, I'm not an EU national, so I also am subject to also all the same visa policies and others. And I was renewing my permit, and I went to renew it the way I had always done it, which was you just show up at the magistrat and submit your papers. And I realized when I was looking at the opening hours that actually, no, the policy had changed post-pandemic. Everything was only online. You could only go to the location if you had an appointment through this online system. And when I went to go register my appointment, there was none available until my permit would have expired. So because of the changes in the bureaucratic approaches, it's not even a change in policy, it's just about how they implement the policy. But that would be a very simple example of someone how they could lose their status just through bureaucratic reasons alone.
Apart from the state, do we also have examples of how other actors have been involved in the evolution of these policies?
That was something that we looked at in terms of as related to how policies have changed over time. So on the one hand, where I mentioned that specific events can trigger policy changes, but then we looked at also how these different interest groups emerge in the policy shifts over time. So as I mentioned before, of course, media coverage and public opinion is really important in shifting and or maintaining an issue on the policy agenda. And irregular migration, particularly post-2015, was really squarely placed high up on the policy agenda. But for example, media coverage can also keep an issue on the policy agenda that might not usually be the case. So in Spain, for example, the issues that were faced by irregular unaccompanied migrant children after they turned 18 have been reported on and debated in various media outlets for years. And in 2021, then there was a legal pathway that was provided for regularization of those children. And this is considered a direct response to the public debate on this issue and the media coverage as well. Also, media outlets have been important in breaking migration-related national scandals, which have led to policy changes in some countries. Another really important stakeholder group that's important in advocating for policy change would be civil society actors. So, of course, this would be migrant associations and NGOs, but also churches are really important here. In Germany, for example, an alliance of churches, welfare organizations, trade unions, and even researchers, they advocated for changes in the legal framework in 2011 to improve irregular migrants' access to healthcare and education. A similar partnership in 2015 also argued for access to regular status for demographic needs. So the perception that, for example, Syrian refugees and their potential to fill these needs at that time was really important. In the Netherlands, the civil society led by the Conference of European Churches and support of also municipalities challenged a court ruling that had limited access to government shelters to only specific groups. This also brings up the role of the courts as well. The judiciary is really important in either restricting or expanding access to certain services. In this case, they were not successful in their court case, but in the end, their advocacy still also led to the expansion of access to shelters in another form. Even employers themselves have been important stakeholders, often through or with trade unions that can also promote more liberal policies towards irregular migrant labor in view of their labor needs. So you have examples of regularizations that have targeted specific sectors due to acute labor demands. You have different actors that are involved in migration policy development and in the governance of migration. And they advocate sometimes for policies that may allow irregular migrants to regularize their status or to access certain services. In our study, we saw examples across these different interest groups and stakeholders. Party politics also can help explain policy changes. What we've seen is that changes in political leadership and coalitions have also reoriented irregular migration policy approaches in most of the countries under study. We found that right-wing coalition governments have tended to implement more restrictive policies towards irregular migrants, and this can imply a wide spectrum of policy interventions. For example, you have also political opposition is really important in shifting to policy shifts. So where you have in France and in the US, even though, for example, Obama was elected on platforms of, for example, more humane approaches to migration, in both cases, in respective countries, they ramped up deportations of irregular migrants. And this has been important in also shifting the policy approach on irregular migration.
I'm quite curious what would be next after Mirim or anything ongoing.
Yeah, we have a number of publications coming out, of course. And also another research strand that's ongoing is a specific research strand on regularization. So that wasn't the focus of our study itself, but the focus of some ongoing research from our partners. And that will also include a number of research questions, including examining this so-called pull effect of regularization policies attracting additional irregular migration.
Thank you very much, Megan and Veronica, for this very, very rich discussion.
Thank you also from my side. I look forward to the future results we will be able to be discussing with you some other time.
Thanks so much for inviting us and allowing us to talk about our study more in depth.
I think one key takeaway for today's discussion is that despite the diversity in approaches and differences in their legal systems, policies of the countries covered in this study all have an impact on how migrants both get into and out of irregularity. We can then look forward to more countries learning from these ways in addressing irregularity in the context of migration adapted in their local contexts, and how stakeholders can all work together. This has been another episode of the Migration Podcast by ICMPD. We'd love to hear your feedback and ideas. Reach out to us via Facebook, X, or LinkedIn. And follow the Migration Podcast series for more discussions, not only on migration as an issue, but more importantly that above all, migration is about people.